This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Abominable fiends and clockwork wizards, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on filmschoolrejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and something
exploitation.
Something, thank you. That's the word.
Cult and exploitation.
Cult and completely flubbing your lines. This is why most podcasts probably write shit down.
Every week, week in, week out, every week, 2.5 years, you do the same line.
Yeah, and my brain just decided to freeze on me like it was being besieged by locusts or something. But yeah, nope, complete brain fart. Cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. And why wouldn't it be good? Clearly, we are motherfucking professionals. That's why we don't flub our intros.
Ever.
I am Brian Salisbury, dubious as that may sound. And joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
He's also...
a lieutenant of Megaforce.
That is goddamn right.
Doctor.
You almost forgot, doctor.
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 And if you would like to hear more of this, because clearly you do, you can check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/... you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you're a big fan of the show, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron of the podcast.
Where this week you'll get a special review, our junk food a la mode of this week's release, Arrival.
Oh, yes. That's the great thing about being a patron is we kick you guys bonus content that only you get to hear as patrons as a way to say thank you for helping us keep the lights on here at Junk Food HQ, which is really just the stock room of a Porky's, or not a Porky's, a Piggly Wiggly. But we're watching Porky's in the back room of this Piggly Wiggly.
I kind of want to watch Porky's in the back room of Piggly Wiggly at some point.
It sounds exactly as filthy as it should, actually, now that I think about it. And hey, if you want to support Cargill directly, maybe go to your local skinema and see an independent film that he co-wrote called... Dr. Mordred?
Dr. Mabuse. Strange.
Oh, yes.
What I think the final title we settled on was.
Yes. The working title was Dr. Mabuse. The final title, Dr. Strange. So, yes, go to cinemas and see
actually,
this.
Actually, the working title was Checkmate. I shit you not. That was actually a big, well-kept secret for a while. And then when we went and shot in Oxford, the word got out. And people were like, it's called Checkmate. So... That got out, but yeah.
Does that relate to something in the Doctor Strange verse?
No. It has to do with something in Kevin Feige's head. He has, like, everything is a little joke. To whatever the movie means in terms of the Marvel Universe, that was, he considered Checkmate to be the thing. I know others have included, like, Full Tilt Boogie and After Party have been the names of other movies. Age of Ultron was After Party. Full Tilt Boogie was Guardians.
Oh, okay. Was Full Tilt Boogie have something to do with From Dusk Till Dawn as well?
Full Tilt Boogie is actually the name of the documentary about the making of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Got it. I'm trying to keep all those things straight. I hear the movie's doing quite well. So
it's doing all right.
So that's pretty cool.
No. And for those of you junkies out there and junkions who went out to support the film this weekend, thank you very, very much.
Look,
it means a lot.
All right, fine. I know you're giving me the sideways glance. I had to work this weekend. I'm sorry, I haven't seen the film yet.
I want to thank those people who came out to support me and support the film.
Haven't seen it yet doesn't mean I'm not going to.
I wasn't inferring or actually implying anything about
you're sipping your tea like a Kermit the Frog meme right now as you're looking at me and saying, like, that's none of my business. And you know what, Cargill, I feel like the movie is doing quite well without my few extra bucks. I hear it's tanking. I'm sorry about that, and I will endeavor to correct it with my box office dollars and be the only one of 10 people that has seen it. Finally get this movie on track by going and putting a few shekels down. I'm sorry.
Well, to tie that in and to segue into the podcast itself.
Segue.
We decided to Stargrow. We decided to do an episode, a whole month of Mr. Doctor.
We're
going to talk about our favorite genre doctors and do a whole bunch of Doctor episodes.
Doctor.
And this week, Doctor, we are doing the Abominable Doctor Fives.
What lovely music for a murder, or two, or three, or nine.
Who's this?
Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to meet a dear friend, Dr. Fives, who experiments with fascinating instruments of death. Are you ready for Dr. Fives?
The Abominable Dr. Fives, which I think may have the distinction of being the first Vincent Price movie we've ever covered on this show.
Which seems weird, doesn't it? Like, it
very
feels
weird.
Like we should have done some more Vincent Price. You know what? No, we have done some Vincent
Price. Oh, edit, take it back. Which one did we do before?
Vincent Price does a voice for, doesn't Vincent Price do a voice in Death Race 2000?
Does he
do like an original Frankenstein or something?
I feel like if he does, we woefully missed that fact when we covered it before.
And maybe I'm just misremembering because I know that they, you know.
Oh, you're thinking of the Thriller video.
Well, there's that. Because who doesn't love the Thriller video?
You're thinking about when David Carradine like puts his arm around the girl and they're walking away and then he turns around and he's got like lizard eyes and then he just cackles. Vincent Price just cackles, yeah. And then that's the end of the movie.
It's been far too long since I've revisited Death Race 2000. And by far too long, I mean, I think I watched it last year.
I was going to say, I really thought you were going to be like last week. But you know, it's been too long. I've got to revisit that. Going to do my weekly viewing of Death Race 2000, which, by the way, does not sound like a bad idea.
It doesn't sound like the worst idea.
No, not at all.
I love Death Race 2000, but as we discussed in our episode on Death Race v. Death Race, I watched Death Race more than I watched Death Race 2000. Death Race is a great 3 a.m. movie when you're up and you're just like, I want to have a couple beers. And that has become one of my dozen go-to movies of like, why don't I watch Death Race? I kind of want to watch Jason Statham drive around a lot and punch people out. Like, that sounds like a good thing to do at 3 a.m.
Yeah, the movie that actually overestimated America's ability to not go into financial ruin because it pegged the collapse of the economy like 2 years after the economy actually collapsed. So
before.
No. The movie pegged that it was going that it was going to be 2 years later than it actually happened. So it actually had a more optimistic view of our country than our actual country did. But
we're back with The Abominable Dr. Fives.
The Abominable Dr. Fives, which
is a delightfully bizarre
so
movie.
Weird, so strange.
This is the epitome of cult. Like, yes. This, when you talk about cult films, this is a movie that every choice it makes is interesting and different and definitely not for mainstream taste. Like, this is a movie for those of you who are willing to accept everything in the movie being fucking weird.
Yes, very much so. This is a movie that is artful and elegant and then screwball and then like very deeply upsettingly dark in its murderous agenda. Like, it just kind of switches gears left and right in that way.
Yeah, and it's the comedy in it is camp.
Yeah.
And it's delightful camp, but then there's some fun character comedy. I mean, the thing that sets this movie apart from other films of its type is it is a serial killer movie before we had slashers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a full decade before we had, you know, the summer of slashers, 1981, that we talk about so frequently. This is a weird, almost monster movie that kills all of these people in a very specific creative way. But at the same time, while we have this resilient, creepy, brilliant genius of a villain, he's met on the other side by a couple of well-meaning, average Joe, almost bumbling cops.
They're bumbling's not, a good word for
they're
them.
They're not actually bumbling, but every time they do something, they just miss it, and they just, you know, don't get going what they're supposed to be doing. You know, they miss somebody's death by a few minutes, or they just get a clue wrong. Their boss comes in to rip them apart, like, and just shred them and make them look like complete Goombas.
Yeah.
And that is just, it's such a weird dichotomy between watching the abominable Dr. Fibes murder these people, each in a different bizarre way, and then watch the cops try to put it together. And the thing is, they're smart cops, and they put it together, and you even have that moment where they're like, no, this is not a thing. You're reaching, you're stretching, but they brilliantly put together that these murders are all connected, and even then, they just get dressed down every time they're on screen.
Yeah.
And it's such a weird tone set between these sequences that make the film delightfully weird.
Yeah, and it's weird because these cops are sort of transmogrified Monty Python cartoons. Like, they're one Queen Victoria hatching a chicken egg away from being a Monty Python interstitial. Like, the way that these bits with them are framed and edited are very much like Python sketches. And it's weird because they start off subtle, and then as the movie goes on, like, you aren't even really aware that you're watching a horror comedy until about an hour in, because they just seem bumbling, but to the extent that you would expect cops to be in a movie like this, where the filmmakers want you to rally behind the killer. But the opening shot of the movie is two of the detectives speaking, and then one of them saying, you know, Hendrix, get this down. And he says, right away, sir. And he goes, where are you? I'm up here. And he's crawling with his ass in the air on top of the wardrobe, like, just this bizarre, like, literally looking for fingerprints with a giant magnifying glass. And then one cop goes into the wardrobe just to meet the other one as he comes out the other side. And it's just like, it's exactly the kind of the editing and the shot composition you would expect from, like, a Python sketch. But even then, you're so focused on, oh, someone was just murdered by fruit bats, so that's clearly what we're supposed to be focused on. And that's one of the craziest things about this, is the movie opens and it's 10 minutes before the first line is spoken. We got ourselves a Manhunter situation here.
Yeah, no, the movie opens with you know, of course, Dr. Fibes playing his organ, which is going to be a theme of this entire movie.
He's phantoming, but
he's phantoming in this really weird fucking surreal setup that just, like, with pieces that just don't totally mesh into what's going on, that eventually some of them get explained away in the all too terrible sequel that we won't be covering. I'm really not a fan of the sequel.
And it's funny because you and I have, like, remembering what the sequel is called. We came up with like 14 different names. I think
it was released under a couple different, but I think the official title is Dr. Fibes Rises Again.
Okay. Yeah. And then it's not Dr. Fibes Strikes Back. And then it led me down a path of, like, Scream, Dr. Fibes Scream, and Dr. Fibes Big Score, and Dr. Fibes Doc
Movies
Harder.
I kind of wish we could see.
Like, yeah, right.
I kind of wish they'd made a whole series and of then, like, bizarre exploitation.
Yeah, because I realized that all of my sequel titles were just sequels from Blaxploitation.
Yeah, they really were. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
But this Doxploitation movie, mad scientist film from American International Pictures.
Yeah, it's just like, he comes up and all of a sudden he walks over and turns a crank and he's got this automaton brass band.
Yeah, these, like, these man-sized tin toys that just start playing this strange music.
Yeah, they just start playing 20s era music, and this is an important thing to make note. The movie takes place in 1925.
Oh, we need to talk about the time conundrum of this film.
Well, yes, because the movie takes place in 1925. You have to put that together because they don't tell you outright. You have to, like, start pulling clues from the movie that this movie technically takes place 4 years after the death of Fibes' wife, and then you find out that she died in 1921. So then you find out it's 1925, but there are several scenes that clearly are set in the 20s.
The date, once you get the concrete date, and I don't just mean that because it's literally posted on a slab of concrete, it raises more questions than it answers, because throughout the film, you're seeing people drive around in cars that I'm pretty sure killed Myrtle and got Gatsby in a whole bunch of trouble. But then you're seeing, like, Joseph Cotten, who is in this movie, and just, I love Joseph Cotten.
We've gotten to Joseph Cotten.
He's phenomenal. But his apartment is the most 70s thing of all time. It looks like the decade literally threw up in there. Between the swirl patterns on the walls and the weird polar bear shag rug that's thrown over the olive couch, and like everything about it is 70s. So you're like, okay, is it, maybe it's a contemporary movie, but then everyone's dressed like it's the teens. But then, you know, like it's just like it's all over the place chronologically. So when you see that date, you're like, oh, okay, good, but wait a minute.
And there's part of me that wonders how much of that 70s aesthetic that we're noticing, we're identifying as the 70s, that was really a retro throwback that was brought back in the 70s. Like that's what has me curious, but not knowing enough about the fashion of the 1920s, because we don't have films that set that in color. So we can't really juxtapose whether or not this is actually very much what this era looked like in Britain at this time, or if they just were like, look, we're an American International's picture. We're shooting this movie in like 8 days. Just make it kind of look passable.
Two alternate theories. One, perhaps it's that thing where when you make a movie in the 80s and you set it in the future 60 years, it's a future that is the future 80s.
Yes.
I wonder if that works in the reverse. I wonder if this is like the 70s trying to recreate the 20s, so you have a 70s version of the 20s. That's theory numero uno. Theory numero dos is that scene with Joseph Cotton.
Your Spanish is really good.
I know, right? It is very gut. Guten Morgen. I forgot what I was doing. But the second theory is that scene with Joseph.
Muy bueno.
Was the scene with Joseph Cotton in his apartment was like an afterthought, like something they had to do in reshoots. And Joseph Cotton was so grizzled at the point that he's like, no, fuck you. Unless you're okay. Coming to my apartment, I'm not shooting any more goddamn scenes for this movie.
I'm killing theory too, because I don't believe American International Pictures knows what the word reshoot means. I have seen enough AIP films in my life that they were just like, we've shot it, it's done.
No, they do. They just think it's when you take the same footage and put it in a completely different movie so that you can sell it twice. That's what an American International reshoot is.
Oh, my. Space Raiders, anybody?
Hey-oh. Which, by the way, is a great sentence. Like, just like that's a junk food cinema clause if ever I heard one. Space Raiders, anyone?
Yeah, there's like 12 people out there who have seen Space Raiders. By the way, don't watch Space Raiders. They literally took all the best footage from Battle Beyond the Stars, which we love, and then built another film around it, and the film they built around it is garbage.
Space Raiders. I just love that on no other podcast will you get the sentence Space Raiders, anyone?
So we've got this setting. It's 1925, and Dr. Fibes is an evil genius, and he has apparently built these automatons, we guess, and has this silent woman working with him, which you might theorize is an automaton at some point, and you're not entirely sure.
I was waiting for the full-on 70s dystopian ending where her face falls off and she's just completely a robot.
Well, she ends up getting melted by acid by the end, so
wouldn't you know it?
You know, you're kind of waiting for that shot where, is she a robot or isn't she? Because otherwise, that character just doesn't make a lick of goddamn sense.
And then James Brolin comes in a cowboy outfit and fucks the shit out of her. Wait, that's a different,
that's a very different
70s
movie.
Robot movie. That is continue.
Very different 70s movie, my friend. So Dr. Fibes then goes from playing the organ and dancing around with his automatons to murdering somebody in a very weird, ornate fashion.
He comes to the house of a surgeon and lowers a cage in through the ceiling window. And we find out that cage was full of bats that then proceed to...
Which are supposed to be vampire bats.
They're supposed to be vampire bats. The thing about it is, like, I'm no zoologicalist, but I have watched...
You can't even pronounce zoologist.
Not muy bueno. But I have watched Planet Earth a time or two, so I'm pretty sure those are fruit bats that end up crawling all over him, which are, like, the most harmless, adorable, like, members of the bat family. So we're supposed to then buy that they're vicious, which is why, if you notice
they're
in that shot...
They're the bat mite of the bat family?
Yes, except way less annoying. But that's why in that shot, it cuts away before, like, the bat's kind of crawling on him. Look at him with this expression of, like, I don't know why I'm here either. Cut. And then the next scene is just him dead. and there are just bats
they're
all over that bedroom.
One of the worst shots of this movie is the bat like crawling up. Like, he's in bed. He's not paralyzed or anything. He's just in bed, and this bat is crawling on him with this look on his face like, I've come to cuddle. Like, can we cuddle, please? I'm very uncomfortable and scared. It's light out, and I shouldn't. There's all these people around and lights, and
please,
I'm very
terrified.
Please,
sir, I'd like a friend. I shouldn't have this accent because I'm in no way from this region of the world.
Yeah. So yeah, but he then gets all the blood sucked out of him by bats.
And then while they're investigating, one of the detectives says something to the effect of, oh, this reminds me of another case we had somewhere else where a surgeon died under mysterious circumstances. He was stung by all of these bees, and it just left boils all over him, and he died. And they're like, I wonder if those things are connected. And of course, because it's this type of movie, he brings this very rational theory about two surgeons killed within 24 hours by mysterious animal incursions. And the commissioner's like, that's poppycock. Your wild theories. Don't you go talking to the press. And it's like, I don't think that's as crazy as you think it is.
Except that it really is. A guy gets stung to death by bees. Another guy gets bats in his house.
If he was stung by bees, like, out on a morning walk, maybe they would seem dubious a connection. But it was like in his parlor. Like, all these bees show up. Just like this guy's bedroom is suddenly fucking bat cave.
It's actually not the most irresponsible reaction from the commissioner. We just know better because we've already watched Dr. Fibes lower this shit into the room.
That's true. And again, it looks like the bat cave, which is why the commissioner's like, don't talk to the press. And he goes, okay, I won't. I swear. Swear to me. And it's like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
So, way to go, British people.
So what we have and what then follows is a movie that I'm convinced entirely inspired the movie Seven.
And it's funny because I'm convinced that Dr. Fibes is a proto Jigsaw.
Oh, I have no doubt. Like, no doubt in my mind when we talk about the conclusion of this film, it would not surprise me if the final sequence of this movie inspired James Wan and Lee Whannell to come up with the concept of Jigsaw, because that's exactly because they took their final scene from another movie
for
Saw.
Yeah.
They took the end of Mad Max. So to go, what if we took the end scene from Mad Max, and what if we took the idea from the end of the abominable Dr. Fibes, and we turned that into the villain?
Fun game. As you watch every kill in Abominable Dr. Fibes, play the that theme song from the first Saw movie. You'll have yourself a good time.
What we have here, we have a killer who is killing off all of these people using the plagues of the Bible, plagues from Exodus. Really interesting to see how he accomplishes them, because some of them are really oddball, like, how the fuck do you kill people with frogs? And so he comes up with creative versions. One of which being a total fucking stretch.
A stretch and a half. And
that then becomes the chief moment of sheer slapstick.
It's the moment you finally realize what type of movie you're watching. But yeah, he's using all the plagues of Egypt that I believe he kept referring to as Ketar. Maybe it's pronounced differently, but every time he said it sounded like
the name
Keita.
One of the doctors involved.
Yeah. Okay. Good, because I thought for a minute he was referencing from the Bible the Book of Gary Newman.
No.
Okay. So not Ketar.
Not
good to know.
So what you end up with is you have this movie about a guy whose wife died being operated on, and he then raced out and ended up in a car accident. Is thought to be dead, but was just horribly fucking maimed by fire and is now this monstrosity of a fucking man. He looks a lot like the zombie from the cover of Fulci's Zombie.
Yes, he does, actually. That's a very apt comparison. I was going to go with a less green-tinted Sleestak from The Land of the Lost.
But you don't actually see that to the climax of the film. The rest of the film is Vincent Price made to look like he's wearing all this cheap makeup. What would be really expensive makeup at the time, you know, like really profound prosthetics. But, you know, nowadays what looks cheap and bad. But he looks like just kind of gross, and he doesn't talk.
No, and that's, I think, one of the great things about his performance in this movie is he's communicating a lot throughout most of the movie without saying a word.
Yeah. And when he does communicate, he plugs in this thing that he's built in his neck. He's used he is a genius, and holds several degrees, but he is a genius musician. And so he's created these musical automatons, and he's got this incredible organ setup. He's known as one of the greatest organists in the world, which, you know, is the 1920s equivalent of being one of the greatest guitarists in the world.
Right, right, right.
They made it today. He might actually be one of the greatest DJs in the world.
And if it was in the 80s, he'd be the great keytarist of the world, and it all comes full circle.
You really are into
keytars. Yes.
I don't know why you're all about keytars.
Because of fucking Flock of Seagulls, that's why.
That's why. That's not one of the plagues of the Bible.
You know what? Neither are bats, Cargill. There's no fucking reference to bats in the plagues of Egypt. Although, my favorite scene
apparently in the Hebrew one, yeah.
No. They took license with, they changed gnats and something else to rats and bats.
Yes.
For the visual look. But my favorite part of that is, instead of acknowledging that they're taking license, they literally go to a rabbi in one scene, and he's like, well, everyone knows. I mean, the established plagues are, and he mentions bats. And I'm like, oh, does everyone know that?
In this alternate
Rabbi universe, horseshit?
In this alternate 1920s, that is what the plagues are. And really, taking anything literal in Fibes and like pointing out the errors of it is kind of missing just how kind of culty and bizarre this fucking movie is. Because bats. Happen. So, but no, he's, in order to talk, he plugs a cable into his neck, into this thing he's built in his neck, and then starts speaking out of a phonograph.
And so everything he says comes out Vincent Price's voice, like he's talking through a vacuum tube.
Nine killed you. Nine shall die.
Welcome to Vincent Price Burger. Would you like to try an apple pie? Yeah, it's very strange the way that it comes out, but you know, at least we know that RCA is going to Vincent Price Burger. Have you never been there
with Keenan and Kel?
It is very
Vincent Price Burger. I'd like to take your order, please.
I'm telling you, it is a disturbing place to have dinner, but I highly recommend it.
So he is really pissed that these nine particular doctors and nurses were responsible for the death of his wife because they couldn't save her. And he has snapped, and he has decided he's going to kill them all inexplicably through the plagues of the Bible.
Yeah, it's dubious as to why this person would latch on to that particular concept, but he really goes at it hard. And I think it's the fun part of this movie is watching the way that he interprets the various plagues into murders, because it's not always just, okay, this animal was the scourge, I'm going to sick this animal on him. There's, you know, and there's one point in the movie, again, the most screwball of screwball moments, where he could have just unleashed, like, you know, a wolf or some other type of vicious animal because it's the plague of beasts. He goes a different route with it. Talk about creative license. There is this, I don't know if I want to jump to that yet, but
I mean, we may as well. Right? I mean, there's plague no reason beasts. To go. Because really, this entire movie, the plot is a person dies, cops show up and try to do a good job. They get some real stuff out of it. They do some real police work, and then they're kind of bungling again. And then we go back to Dr. Fibes, and then somebody dies, and then the police show up. And it really is just going back and forth. And occasionally, in a weird act of editing, they will question, like, what is he doing with this? And we'll cut immediately to Dr. Fibes doing the thing that makes sense, that puts the pieces together, and then cutting right back.
I call that the I'm glad you asked edit.
Yeah.
Where it's just Dr. Fibes like, oh, well, I'm glad you asked. I'm going to pour it on her face and then make Locust eat her. But this particular, the way they interpret the plague of beasts is one of the last doctors of this group is being put under police protection, and he's walking to an elevator, and he's resisting the idea of police protection. My patients need me. I'm not going away for any. The elevator doors open, and something hurls at him and pins him to the wall, and we see that it is a brass-coated unicorn.
It's a unicorn, brass unicorn bust that was hurled by catapult across the street and impales him through the wall. And in order to get them out, they have to unscrew it from the wall. And so you constantly see these feet like squeaky, 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 up around the side. That's the moment that you're like, okay, this is slapstick.
Yeah.
Like, this entire movie is not meant to be taken seriously. This is supposed to be funny and weird for the sake of being funny and weird. And that's the final moment where you're like, oh, shit. Like, all this stuff that seems goofy is supposed to be goofy.
Right.
And it recontextualizes the whole movie. But you're right. It's a brass unicorn. That's how he uses beats. Like, he's gone and spent time trying to get bats to kill people. He's got rats to kill a guy flying a plane. He's, you know, he's funneling bees into the house to sting a person to death. And then it comes to beasts, and it's like, this is so obvious. And it's like, nope.
Nope.
Gotcha. You didn't see this one coming.
No, no one did.
And yeah, oddly enough, I don't recall there being any unicorns in the Bible.
Yeah, I'm thinking back on it, and there are definitely no unicorns in the Old Testament.
I mean, they didn't get on the ark.
Oh,
like, that's the whole thing. Yeah. They drowned in the flood. They were they got to the end, and Noah was just like, yeah, sorry guys, there's just no room.
And if my Alabama schoolwork learning is not failing me, I'm pretty sure the dinosaurs also failed to get on the ark.
That is correct.
They existed at the same time, right?
Especially the pterodactyls.
Oh, for sure the pterodactyls. Because they can't just fly off Isla Nublar. John Hammond, for fuck's sake, if you really want those dinosaurs to just be left alone and they're never going to bother anybody, don't fucking engineer pterodactyls that can fly off the island. Are you out of your goddamn mind?
Yes, he was.
That's
kind of
right.
The whole point to John Hammond.
Woohoo! I'm rich! Oh, that's right. I forgot. He was basically mad scientist Scrooge McDuck.
He's the kindly Dr. Moreau.
He is kindly Dr. Moreau.
He seems like such a nice guy until he gets an entire island full of people killed.
Woohoo, Bryce Dallas Howard, I'm going to turn you into a raptor, Bryce Dallas Howard. Woohoo, I'm rich. What were we talking about? We were talking about unicorns.
Dr. Fox.
Talking about unicorns flying through the air, mass hysteria, impaling people into walls. And then, yes, that shot where they keep cutting to the guy reading in the lobby is you just see feet. You hear the sound of, like, unscrewing, and then a guy's feet that just keep going around in circles. And you're like, oh, comedy. But one of the things that throws you off from knowing that it's a comedy is every once in a while they'll cut to these very artistic vignettes that I swear to God, for a moment I was like, are we watching a Jodorowsky film? Because there's a woman in a giant headdress, there's all of this music being played, there's random dance numbers and all these patterns on the wall. It was very surreal. Like, in moments this movie gets entirely surreal. And you don't have any clue what it is you're actually looking at.
Yeah. And it's a bizarrely shot film as well. It's incredibly British in terms of the cinematography of that era, where you've got just these really weird deep field shots where the camera is on one side of the room and what's going on is the other side of the room.
Yeah.
And it looks really cool and it looks really weird, but it's just kind of out of place. And so the whole movie is just a little bit unsettling.
Yeah.
Like, just everything about it is throwing you off. Like, occasional cuts to weird angles on, you know, on headlights and weird things like this, that it's always kind of throwing you off and making you unsure, which is one of the things I find most interesting about this film.
And then, of course, there's that other surreal element of the woman who's his assistant is constantly playing a violin.
The woman who's his assistant doesn't say a word.
No.
She's playing the violin. She's doing everything he needs her to do, but she doesn't make any sense to character.
No. She is basically, there's one shot where she's walking around in this giant, like almost beef eater hat and walking a greyhound. And for a moment I was like, oh, we've wandered into a vodka commercial from the 60s. But that's apparently all part of a lure to trap someone. But it just seems like, yeah, she's in a different...
Someone he kills with hail.
Ostensibly with hail. It really just looks like Snoke hockey, because it's just like he's in the backseat of a car and a snow cone machine is being fired directly into his face. And I guess he just didn't move. Did they explain why he couldn't just move out of the way of this thing?
There's so many people that die because they don't move in this movie. It's one of the weird camps out of it.
You know, like, what it
why
is?
Why does the vampire bat guy not hit the vampire bats off
because...
and then run out going, help, my room is full of vampire bats.
No.
It kind of sits there and cowers.
Because they're British and they are too polite for that.
I feel like they they only like figured it out towards the end of the movie to explain it when they try to explain why the locust thing actually goes off.
Yeah.
Because it's like,
speaking of Bukkake,
I can't sleep tonight. Well, take a sleeping pill. Now we have an explanation why she's laying there still while he pours all this weird green, syrupy, sugary stuff on.
Made from Brussels sprouts. He somehow distills sucrose from Brussels sprouts.
And then pours in all these locusts that then has one of the cooler shots of the movie where the locusts have just picked her clean.
Yeah.
It's literally just her skeleton and a bits of flesh left.
Oh, it's Mrs. Bates pulled out of the fruit cellar and stuffed in a hospital bed. Like, it is full on skeleton with a wig. But yeah, so all of these things are going on and you're completely taken out of the movie every once in a while by her playing the violin. And there's one shot where like, he's sitting in a chair that has a hole in the backrest, and you can see her through the hole playing the violin. So it's framed in such a way that, with forced perspective, it looks like she's sitting on his shoulder, which is really bizarre. And, you know, and so he's killed. So he kills the guy with bats. This is after the off-screen death of someone with bees. And then we are introduced to one particular doctor with a penchant for, I don't even know if you could call it porn. It's like belly dancing videos.
Well, I mean, keep in mind that this movie's taking place in the 20s.
See, and you, this is the first hint I think we get of that, because he's watching it on a like hand cranked Edison projector. He's literally cranking it to this video of a woman belly dancing.
He's cranking it to a woman. And also, it's a movie being made in the 70s, the early 70s. So you're not seeing, they're playing around with the whole. They're giving you the idea that it's porn, but without showing you actual porn. And it's actually really kind of comical how they do it, because it's a belly dancer who has a snake, and she's doing a snake dance and slowly lowering a snake down her throat as he gets more and more excited. And I thought it was actually one of the better jokes in the movie, where it's really this guy's getting excited for this.
I don't get it. I'm too polite to get that joke.
No, you're really not.
I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Bat. Were you trying to murder me? Oh, go right ahead. No, please, after you.
And then this mysterious woman walks in, and he's like, "Oh, hi. I was watching
this just
porn.
Got this interesting. Got
interesting." And lets him mysteriously tie him up. And then Dr. Fibes comes in to murder him. And actually, in one of the more understandable deaths of the movie, it's like, oh, he's just draining him of blood while he's still alive and letting him slowly pass out.
Yeah.
And which is kind of sounds awful.
But I like the way this particular death is shot, because the way that they do it is they cut to like close-ups of Fibes, they cut to close-ups of the doctor in the chair, and then they cut to the mantle where he's placing the bottles of blood, and every time they cut to the mantle, there's another bottle there. So you're slowly understanding how much blood that he's taking out of him. I just thought that was really cool the way that was shot. It was almost like a reverse 10 Little Indians, where like a bottle was being put back on the shelf every time they cut back.
Yeah. No, and it's, that particular death is a little creepier in that regard, because you kind of think, oh, this is kind of awful.
And creepier because they're apparently siphoning off all of the Hawaiian punch in this man's system.
They really kind
of it's carbon. His blood is carbonated.
Well, keep in mind that the blood at this point, they hadn't quite perfected.
This is true.
Theater blood. They haven't quite perfected cinema blood yet to make it look authentic. Cinema blood, what we think of as cinema blood, doesn't really tend to look like real blood anyway. It just looks what we tend to think of what blood tends to look like.
That's some deep stuff right there.
Yeah, but that's a particularly cool scene. But then we get to the third act.
Yeah, and we still haven't mentioned Joseph fucking Cotton.
Well, we've mentioned it,
but we haven't gotten to that and who he plays.
Joseph Cotton is one of the investigators working on this case.
Well, no, he becomes one of the investigators. He kind of attaches himself, but who he's really playing is the head surgeon or the head medical professional who was overseeing this surgery, and all of these other doctors actually worked with him, which is why the police go to him. Is he's the first person they figure out, oh, wait a minute, all of these people, that all these doctors that have been killed have worked with one particular other doctor, and it's the character played by Joseph Cotton. And then he just decides to involve, he decides to deputize himself and involve himself in the investigation.
Yeah.
and it, which is seems extremely dangerous for someone who's probably going to be next on the list at any moment. But it's just like, sure, let me follow you around.
Well, but he actually explains that away fairly early by saying, well, honestly, I think I'm going to be last. I think he's saving something special for me.
Speaking of shoddy investigation work, can we talk about the scene of Joseph Cotton and his superfluous files? His unnecessary stack of files.
This is one of the most ridiculous things, and which I again, once you understand that they're ostensibly making a comedy here, it really is very funny because he's like, okay, so here's a pile of every single case I've worked on in the last 5 years, and then he puts down a number
he's
on top.
Written it down like it's a,
he's written it down
like someone's gonna take a ransom note picture. He's written it on a single sheet of paper.
So here's the number of files this is, and then he steps up and he goes, here's the number of files where I worked with any of the people that have been murdered, and he puts down the number on that, like 213. Is and these are the number of files where I worked with multiples of them, and then he gets to the end, and there's a single file there, and he's like, but this is the only file that
the only case I've worked with all of them
worked on.
Why didn't you just stick with that one? Start there. Leave the other ones alone.
He literally just held up a file. He goes, I looked into it, and this is the only file where, you know, that's all you have to do. But you know, he makes a meal out of it.
I don't know. He does make
a whole meal out of it.
He digests the hell out of it. It's almost like, I don't know how carnivals work in England, but it's almost like he was going to a guess the number of files on the table contest, and he really wanted to win that teddy bear, because he's just like, this deck has this many, and this deck, it's like, dude, if you know there's only one case with which you worked with all of these doctors, maybe just focus on that one and stop counting the rest of your files. It's almost like he's bragging, like, ah, look at the size of this stack, right? Yeah, I'm Joseph Cotton.
It's a bit fucking inexplicable.
Joseph Cotton, who, by the way, if you haven't seen the Alfred Hitchcock movie, Shadow of a Doubt, you need to go out and see that immediately. It's one of the best movies of Hitchcock's canon. It's the one where, you know, he fucking worked with Thornton Wilder on the screenplay, and Joseph Cotton plays this amazing character who we all know is evil, but is brought into a small town and causes all of this malice, and it's so good, so good. And of course, isn't he also in the Third Man, right? It's Joseph Cotton and Orson Welles in The Third Man, which is also another amazing film. And this is Joseph Cotton at his
Cotton pickinist
just doesn't seem to give a fuck anymore. But it's right in the middle before he went into full on. Before you get to like the Australian movies, like right before he died, that were just scraping him up for no money, like movies like The Survivor, where it was like, oh shit, you used to be amazing, and now you're almost dead. So it's like right in the middle on the spectrum of Joseph Cotton. This is like right at the midpoint. And what I love about it is they make no attempt to explain why one of the most prominent surgeons in England is an American. They don't care. Like,
I don't think that means anything at all.
He doesn't try to have an accent.
If the leading surgeon at Johns Hopkins in a movie had a British accent, you'd just be like, oh, he's just one of the best surgeons.
Yes, but what I've learned from American television is if we're going to bring a British person over here to be an amazing doctor, we force them to have an American accent, a la Dr. House. I want to talk for a second about what I think is the biggest problem with this movie. And we've mentioned that it is, in fact, undeniably British, and I think what goes along with that a lot of the time is that this movie not only is very dry,
as the desert
on free sandpaper day, it is paced like sweet sugary molasses. And as you get to that ending where it should be ratcheting things up, we take a few more diversions into those Jodorowsky moments. There's a scene where he is dancing with his assistant lady that doesn't really further anything other than to be artful again, which is fine, but it's set exactly at the point where things should be moving faster, not slowing down, and it's like it kind of drags toward that ending, and then it ends on a note of like, goodbye movie.
I feel like they had 60 minutes of movie
plotted
and then ended up wanting a 90 minute movie, so I feel like that's ultimately what happened here. And the thing is it drags, but it's not dull. It's everything that goes on there is really kind of artful.
Oh, it's very artful.
Looks neat. And at the same time is never, you know what I feel this movie's biggest hampering is? I feel like this is a movie that wanted to be made for a significantly larger budget.
Oh, for sure.
And they just didn't have it. Like, they, you know, there's that whole scene at the end where he's like, go destroy everything I have. I'm sorry. Go destroy everything I have built. And
yeah, they definitely wanted to burn that house down.
She takes an axe and she like starts cutting through like one of the
scrims.
Drapes,
yeah.
And like knocks over a drum and that's it. And then she stopped. It's, you know, that was like the lamest destruction that I've seen.
Yeah.
It's like
which is really just the setup for a joke because the two cops poke their heads into, because the scrims that drop down are like, you know, if you're throwing a party at the old Overlook Hotel and you want it to look like the 20s again because you've always been here, these scrims drop down with all these drawings of people partying in like Monte Carlo in the 20s, and she cuts into two of the characters on the scrim, and wouldn't you know it, the two cops pop right into where those heads used to be, so it looks like a carnival photo.
Yeah.
And that's really, but yeah, I think you're right. I think in the original idea was like, let's burn this fucking house to the ground. Let's end on a big fiery climax. And then somebody went, yeah, but he ends up like hiding in the house with his dead wife's corpse, so he can't burn it down.
Yeah. Well, but that leads us, you know, here we're talking about the third act, and the third act is where the biggest of the ideas are. This is where the movie gets really, really fucking interesting. Because we have two things that happen here. First, we have the 10th murder, which is baffling the first time you watch it. You're like, why is he doing the 10 plagues when there are 9 victims? Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliantly resolved. I love the end of this movie. I love, love, love the end of this movie. But that leads up to the 9th kind of murder, which isn't a murder, which is what's interesting.
It's the firstborn plague.
Where it's the firstborn, and this is where he's kidnapped the surgeon's son. The surgeon was right when he said, I feel like he's saving something special for me, and he does. And of course they go out to Fibes' place, and Fibes has set up a saw-like thing.
The abominable Dr. Jigsaw.
This is why I honestly think this is what inspired Juan and Lee Whannell, is you've got this bizarre contraption that will drop acid exactly 6 minutes after it's turned on onto this boy who is chained and anesthetized in an operating room below it. And the doctor has 6 minutes to operate into his son to get a key that will unchain his son. And he has to perform the surgery right and not kill his son, which is a very cool idea that they don't actually show the actual surgery of it because there's a huge gaping plot hole here, which is how did the key get put in? It must have been put in surgically. So wouldn't you just go in
just cut the stitches.
Original surgical
just
star?
Cut the stitches.
But yeah, cut through the stitches and like, oh, there it is. Oh, I thought it would take more time.
It's the equivalent, a surgical equivalent of a map in the mall that says you are here and then asking you to find someplace.
The only thing I can, you know, come up with is that he did the surgery through the back, and since the boy is, you know, strapped down, he actually has to go in through the front.
I just imagine him. That's fair.
Which could be the case, and Dr. Fives is kind of a fucking genius who creates automatons in the 1920s and has systematically managed to kill people with ordinary, you know, everyday animals.
Like fruit bats?
And brass unicorns.
Unicorns, sure.
Because, fuck it, why not? So, yeah.
And then there's, of course, the Forbidden Zone murder that we didn't talk about, where a guy in a frog mask is slowly suffocated.
Yes, the guy in the frog mask gets put in a frog mask. That's how they creatively kill him with frogs. But the mask keeps tightening and tightening and tightening until he's being strangled and nobody else knows what's going on. And then he reds out and collapses down the stairs.
My favorite part of that is there are actual poison frogs. And this is the one, like, there are no bats in the Bible, but we're going to invent that so we can throw harmless fruit bats at somebody and just presume that he is murdered by them. But there are actual poison frogs in the world, but we're going to kill him with a frog mask.
Sure.
Dr. Fibes is one fucked up individual.
And it's a weird fucking movie. But
Jig Fibes.
But it's also really kind of a cool sequence where everybody's wearing masks at the ball, and the mask is like tightening up, and he's like freaking out, and nobody really knows what's going on, and it's really it's an interesting horror moment. It's really kind of cool. I actually quite enjoy that.
Yeah, that's pretty fantastic.
So we've got now we have to do surgery on the son to get the key out while Dr. Fiveson goes and starts playing himself off. And
which means so many different things in this movie.
But it's true. He goes up and
he just gets out there, do 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 do, and then he's like, I want to play a game. And Joseph Cotton's like, I can't understand a word you're saying. I'm sorry.
So yeah, so he then goes down, and Joseph Cotton saves his son, and unchains him just in time for the assistant to come in. Being chased by the cops and accidentally stands into the acid, and then she gets destroyed by the
acid. You don't want to stand into the acid, bro.
But then Dr. Fibes goes down into his basement and has this really cool tomb set up for him and his wife, and then has an embalming station set up where he drains his own blood, and it has embalming fluid putting in. And they've got the he's got the door set to close as soon as the organ is played again to come down. So when the guys come down, Dr. Fibes is gone and he somehow escaped and they have no idea where he is. And that's the end of the movie where Dr. Fibes fucking gets away with it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, is that's why I think this is very much the origin of Seven, that I feel like somebody said, you know what would be cool and how to update this movie 25 years later is, what if we made it the Seven Deadly Sins and he forces people to have to do these Seven Deadly Sins, much like...
He made me fuck her!
Much like the key section. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. You're going to die if you don't do this, and then they die anyway doing it. And so you end up with, I really feel like once you watch the Abominable Dr. Fives, you feel all the origins for Seven, right down to him getting away with it and him dying as part of the thing, him being the seventh death. And,
what's in the box?
Yeah. He's the seventh death. He's Wrath. And that's the end of Dr. Fives. Dr. Fives is... he gets the darkness, and the darkness is death, and him going into death with his wife to spend eternity lying next to her in their casket at the bottom of their house. Here's a little point I would like to make.
Throw it out.
This is really one of those a simpler time things, and I feel like because the director of this film,
as in the Old Testament times.
No. The director of this film would go on to do some other... He had a whole crazy career. He did Wuthering Heights. He did this. He did the sequel. He did...
Devil's Reign.
Devil's Reign. A movie we probably will cover at some point. I don't know how you'll feel about it. I don't think you've seen it.
How dare you suggest that? It's clearly a classic.
Shatner and like John Travolta's first appearance. Like, yeah, that movie's... And that sequence is... That end sequence... Fucking batshit.
The titular Devil's Reign.
Yeah.
What the whole movie is leading up to.
Leading up to Devil's Reign, and the Devil's Reign fucking lives up to it. It's a crazy bug fuck.
Alternate title, People Gonna Get Melted.
But this, the director was born in 1927. So he was making a movie all about, you know, the era that he grew up with as a child. And so I feel like a lot of the ephemera there is something that he's looking back on, the same way that I might, you know, I might write a story about set in the 70s and, you know, with the 70s aesthetic, like, you know, that whole kind of thing. And so this movie has a lot of that throwback stuff. And one of those throwback things is Dr. Fibes is trying to get revenge for the death of his wife. But his wife is only appears to be 26 years old.
Yeah.
26, 27 years old. So, and he is fucking Vincent Price in the 70s. So he's not young. Like, he's in his late 60s. So this is not a woman he has either A, spent a lot of time with, or B, he married when she was like 15. So,
or here's a theory I just came up with. So when they go to visit Dr. Fibes' grave, they pull open the sarcophagus and there's a box of ashes. And Joseph Cotton's like, see, satisfied, he's dead. And the detective's like, I'm not sure I am satisfied because that could be anyone. And maybe it's his chauffeur. And I was like, hold the phone. The chauffeur. All throughout this movie, Dr. Fibes is kind of obsessed with his car and being driven around. He's got these paintings of his own face in profile in the back of his head. Like almost like when you go to the fair and somebody does one of those old-timey photos or a caricature of you. That's what it looks like. And he's constantly being driven around. He loves to be driven around by this this woman whose name, by the way, is
Volnavia.
Volnavia. Which is like, you know, Costanza trying to guess what her name is. But I wonder, what if that's the chauffeur? What if Dr. Fibes did die and the guy who lived was his chauffeur and just kind of assumed this life of great wealth and prominence that he always wanted to have, always coveted everything Dr. Fibes had, including his wife, and just kind of decided to carry on this revenge plot in honor of what happened. And that's why he loves being driven around so much. That's why he now paints his face all over the car, because now he gets to ride in the backseat like an affluent gentleman.
That's a great theory, Cotton. Let's see how that pans out. that doesn't make any fucking sense at all, my friend. That literally, like...
But the chauffeur was the religious
chauffeur
one.
Who builds automaton.
No. Those were already built by Dr. Fibes. All he did was step in there and play the organ, but the automatons were already built by Dr.
Also
Fibes.
He had to come up with a brilliant plan on how to kill people with bees.
Well, but see, that's what I'm saying, is maybe the chauffeur was the religious zealot, not Dr. Fibes, and that's why all of a sudden it's like all of my murders are going to be based on the 10 plagues of Egypt, because... No? All right. No.
Not going to happen. That one won't fly, my
Because
friend.
He identifies with the Israelites because he feels enslaved by Dr. Fibes.
Look at that. I'm reaching for this candy bar and I'm not alone.
I'm reaching like a brass-coated unicorn and it's just not panning out.
Yeah, no, it's, that is definitely not. But it's kind of weird when you think about it. Like, this guy who has just murdered eight people and almost murdered a ninth, is so obsessed with this woman who's got to be 35, 40 years younger than him, which, again, something from a different time. That was acceptable at that era, that an older, you know, established gentleman in his 50s might marry a girl in her early 20s or late teens. But that is, here it's just, you know, when you think about it in context, it's little ooky.
Yeah.
Little kind of like, what you doing there, Grandpa? Grandpa Price. And why are you hanging out with this other, you know, stone cold fox?
Maybe Dr. Fibes is also an oil tycoon from Texas. Maybe
it's
that's
entirely possible.
Why he's attracting these women.
Yeah, but that is very much what is going on. This movie is just, everything about it is just kind of weird and awesome in its own way. And I honestly believe is the core nugget for Saw and for Seven. These films, they just really, they seem to draw and want to improve on Dr. Fibes. And I agree they do. Like, Dr. Fibes is a wonderful piece of cult entertainment. But it is not one of those movies that is going to stand the test of time in the way that, like, Seven has. Really is a wonderful little oddity, and it's a lot of fun to watch, and it's definitely something you should see at least once. But it is definitely not... I feel that Saw and Seven developed that core idea into something significantly better. But it's so cool to kind of see this movie and see how those movies really kind of originated and where the germ of that idea came from.
And in a moment that I'm calling validation verification, I just found this on the IMDb ticker. The writer, William Goldstein, said that Volnavia was originally meant to be another clockwork device.
An automaton, yeah.
Yeah, she was supposed to have a wind-up key in her neck and everything, and but then he changed it because he thought Fibes needed to have a more mobile assistant, so they made her human, but the blank facial expression, the mechanical movements are a carryover from when she was going to be a clockwork device. So
I still believe she is. Like, we never actually see her body.
Yeah.
So I mean, that was one of the things about it, was that it still very much could be her clockwork. And that makes the movie make sense.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why the fuck does he have this woman, and why does she end up
getting maroneyed she's Harvey Dent? Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to say. But one of the things we talked about with not knowing what to do with this movie, this is one of the premier examples of completely flubbing the marketing for a film.
Oh, yeah.
They decided to use the tagline, "Love means never having to say you're ugly," which is kind of a reference to Dr. Phibes' scarred face and more a play off the tagline to the very popular film from a year before, Love Story, which was "Love means never having to say you're sorry."
Yeah.
Which is also a completely bullshit, awful... I hate that movie so much.
Really?
Like, "Love means never having to say you're sorry"? Bullshit. If you fuck up, say you're... Like, that makes no sense.
I thought you were
talking
about Love Story. I thought you were, like,
that,
shitting on
that
Love
That tagline is fucking terrible. But anyway...
That became a really popular thing in that era. That actually triggered a whole... There's a whole comic series of Love Is... That was just comics that you'd see in the newspaper and such. It was really...
Yeah, bell bottoms were popular, too. But... What's crazy about it is
next
people...
Next, you're going to be making fun of Casey and the Sunshine Band, you motherfucker.
I am your boogeyman. No, I'd make fun of Skip It before I would make fun of that. Like, a lot of trends I just don't understand. There's a counter on the ball. It's like, that's great. Just you're basically an inmate in the yard with that toy. Anyway, that tagline caused a big problem because people thought it was a romantic film, and a lot of the hardcore horror fans didn't even bother to go see it. They didn't know what type of movie it was.
But it did end up being a hit.
When they changed the tagline.
Yeah, and American International, they hated the movie. Like, they hated it. They thought it was a terrible movie, and then it was a big hit. And then the entire mood changed, and they're like, oh, wow, people like it. Now we got to make a sequel.
Yeah, which is actually not a terrible film.
I don't like it.
It's not as good as this one. I will grant you that.
I'll tell you why I really, really don't like it. Like, the issues of the movie aside, the ending of Dr. Phibes is beautiful. It is elegant. It is great storytelling. It is this guy who understands that the deaths that he's causing, he must pay for.
Yeah.
And so he does, but he pays for it in his own way and in his own time, where he dies having done what he needs to do, having made the people suffer he believes deserve to suffer, and as a result, he dies alongside his wife where he belongs. The only thing that I would really, you know, like, if I were to, like, remake this or see someone else remake this, what I'd like...
Are you in the process of remaking this?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because I feel like we ran into this once before.
No. This is not one of those cases where I'm working on this. No, which is why I wouldn't mention this if I were working on this. But I kind of wish, this is my wish for this movie, I wish that the surgeon had been drinking that night, the night that his wife came in.
Yeah.
And no one else stopped him because they knew he was drunk or intoxicated, but they didn't have another surgeon on call that could do exactly what he did, and they all assisted, and they all made the choice to allow him to operate on this woman, and the woman died on the table, which may or may not have had anything to do with him drinking. And the reason I wish that is because I wish Phibes at the end would then have gotten, you know, forced alcohol in some way, shape, or form, in some brilliant Dr. Phibes way, gotten the surgeon drunk, and then had to operate on his son intoxicated.
Isn't that the deal with Cary Elwes' character in Saw, that he's like a surgeon, but he's has his drinking problem now, and that's why Jigsaw's all over him, because he's not appreciating life anymore?
That's part of it, yeah.
Because I know for a fact, and it just
but
came
he,
to me, he
Jigsaw
is a doctor.
Wants him to appreciate life.
Yeah.
That's not what Phibes wants. Phibes wants this guy to suffer.
Yeah.
He wants him to go through, you know, to possibly kill his son unless he can save his son. But saving his son, having the sight of his son remind him of this failure that got all of these other people killed. Like, one way or the other, this guy's going to have a terrible fate. He's either going to be responsible for killing his son, or he's going to be constantly reminded that his failure as a doctor got 8 other people killed, and he's going to think that every time he sees his son. So this is a brilliant ending for Phibes, and then to have Phibes crawl into that beautiful ornately made two-person casket that has kind of a almost Flash Gordon-esque tomb cover, you know, with the sun and the moon and the earth, and the earth cast into darkness in the umbra of the moon, is just so fucking cool. And I feel like the entire movie is all about, let's get to this amazing ending. And I love this ending. And the problem with Dr. Phibes Rises Again is it robs that ending if Dr. Phibes can rise from the dead.
Dr. Phibes' badass song, I believe the second one's called.
Yeah. Yeah, so by robbing us of that final ending, of the finality of Dr. Fives giving himself over to this and slipping into the darkness, you ruin what was great about that ending. And it's just like, oh, he's set it up so he goes to sleep for a while. Like, fuck that. That's not the end of the movie. The end of the movie is the guy killing himself as the final death and the final plague. And that's what makes this movie what it is. And that's what I love about this movie. It has the balls to give us a really great fucking ending. And our bumbling cops remain bumbling and don't solve the crime. Yeah. And they don't prevent any of the murders. And they're just kind of there for comic relief and to explain the movie to us, because Dr. Fives doesn't talk most of the time. So yep. I feel like by robbing us of that ending, that entire movie's existence shits on the initial movie.
That's totally fair. I mean, Dr. Fives is not Jigsaw, but he's kind of proto-Saw. So I guess live or die, make your choice. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which I kept thinking about the fact that we're covering all these doctors this month and the fact that Dr. Fives himself has multiple faces, one that he presents to the world and, of course, his horribly scarred face underneath all the makeup. And it made me think of the many faces of Dr. Pepper. And by that, I mean...
the Dr. Pepper knockoffs.
The Dr. Pepper knockoffs.
And in true Mr. Doctor fashion, we have Mr. Pibb.
That's true. We do have Mr. Dr. Pibb. But I was looking just at this image from all of these Dr. Pepper knockoffs from all these local grocery stores and seeing names like Dr. Choice, Dr. Bold, Dr. Perfect, Dr. Bob, Dr. Skipper,
Dr. Thunder,
Dr. Thunder, of course, the Walmart brand, Dr. Shasta, Dr. Perky, Dr. Snap, Dr. Shaw's, and Dr. A+.
And none of those,
just to name a few.
And none of those are my actual favorite knockoff.
There's what's your favorite?
It's an oddball choice. There was there used to be this chain here in Texas called Stop and Go, and Stop and Go's were everywhere. They were just peppered everywhere, and we didn't really have many 7-Elevens.
Were they Dr. Peppered everywhere?
No, they were not.
Hey-o.
So they made this... Stop and Go at one point decided to make their own brand of sodas, their own knockoff brands, which were a dollar cheaper than, you know, the others, which at the time was a big deal. It was like, you know, you could spend $3 on a 12 pack of Dr. Pepper or $2 on a 12 pack of Simply Great Texas Spice. As
what?
It's called, Texas Spice.
Was that melange?
It was
the
life.
Okay.
Texas Spice is life. And it was actually, I'm a huge Dr. Pepper fan, as many people know. And I actually really like Texas Spice better than Dr. Pepper. And then one day it was gone. And they're like, yeah, that experiment didn't work. Apparently I was the only one drinking it.
Well, you and the Harkonnens, I think.
Me and the Harkonnens.
We're the only ones drinking it. Dr. Spice. But what's it called?
Simply Great Texas Spice.
Simply Great.
Simply Great was the name of the brand. So it was like Simply Great Cola, Simply Great Diet Cola, Simply Great Texas Spice.
And you know what? This could have also applied to last week's movie as well, the Doctor Strange ripoff Dr. Mordred, had I come up with the idea of doing Dr. Pepper-themed junk food pairing. So kind of spread this over both this and the last movie, just to be sure. And thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We hope that you've enjoyed it. If you did, you can find more episodes on our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, or follow us on Twitter, which we highly suggest you do, @junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, become a patron. You can literally give us as little as $1 per episode, and by doing so, you will get access to all the bonus content that we provide. Of course, the more that you give, the longer we can keep doing this show, so we really do appreciate that. You can also support Mr. Cargill by going to the theaters, as I have not done yet, and seeing Doctor Strange. See it in IMAX. See it in...
Oh, IMAX, the new Laser IMAX. If you have not tried out Laser IMAX, if your town has one of the Laser IMAX systems, oh my God.
Go see Laser Floyd at the Doctor Strange area.
So I did not like the old IMAX 3D. I love the new Laser IMAX 3D. It is gorgeous. It is bright. It is fantastic. See the movie in 3D. See the movie in 2D, whichever you prefer.
All the D's. Drop some D's on it.
Or I hear if you live in the right cities, you can see it in 4DX, which is how Kevin Smith saw it.
What?
Yeah. In a strange twist of fate, I listened to a movie review by Kevin Smith of my movie. Like, I have slipped into an alternate universe. I'm like, what the happy horse shit is going on? I have Kevin Smith reviewing my movie. Like, that's the antithesis of everything that I did for a living.
Hey, Serpent, tell me how your tail tastes. Yeah, that's crazy.
But yeah, so that's playing. You can also... if you enjoy the dulcet tones of my voice, you can head over to Movie Crypt by our friends Adam Green and Joe Lynch, where I'm doing an interview where I talk about the entire journey of me from a video store clerk to writing Doctor Strange, so that's over at Movie Crypt. And then of course you can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right. Well, that's where you can find us and join us next week when we will be talking about what film, Mr. Cargill?
Next week, we're talking about The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
So we are keeping the Doctor theme on point.
We're going to keep the Doctor theme going all November. We have Doctor films that we've been wanting to talk about, and this gives us a great excuse to keep talking about the Mr. Doctors. So next week, let's talk about Terry Gilliam's Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. You have your homework, junkies. We'll see you next week.
Doctor?